I see something that pattern that always happens at Mises U. I've been here many years, is once again fulfilled. I find when I lecture at Mises U, each of my lectures gets fewer people than the preceding one. I find this is invariably the case. I suspect one reason for this, other than that I'm rather dull speaker, is that they give me all these very hard philosophy topics to lecture about. You know, my great friend, Father James Sadowski, used to say to his philosophy classes, the word philosophy comes from the Greek word philosophia, which means philosophy. Another one of his was his argument for free will is we wouldn't have the concept of free will unless we had it. And I told Bob Nozick that once, and he said, maybe we wouldn't have a concept of bad arguments unless we had it. Now, what I want to talk about today is theory in history, the philosophy of history. And here, the best book to read is the book by Mises that came out in 1957 called Theory in History. Friedrich Hayek thought very highly of that book. He told me how much he admired that book when I was in his class in 1969. Now, I want to start by noting there are two meanings to philosophy of history that correspond to the two meanings of history. When we're talking about history, we can mean events that have happened. We can mean, on the one hand, events that have happened in the past. Say we talk about the history of the Roman Empire, history of the English Civil War, the American Civil War. They're talking about what people have done in the past, but we can also mean by history, we can refer to the activity of the historian in writing about such events. Sometimes people use the rather fancy word historiography for that. So if you're, sometimes people say, well, we're talking about the history of the Civil War, where what they're really talking about are interpretations that various historians have made of the Civil War, or we can be talking about how the historian works and acquires knowledge. So similarly, when we talk about philosophy of history, there is a parallel distinction. We can mean by philosophy of history some kind of explanation of history as a whole. Some people believe that there is a pattern in history, and they have Karl Marx and Oswald Spengler were people who thought that. They said there's some kind of, in addition to, say, we're talking about the history of England or history of America, we can talk about, of course, we can talk about world history, but they thought there's a pattern in all of history, and that's what they meant by philosophy of history. And corresponding to the other meaning of history, we can talk about philosophy of history, meaning philosophical problems in how the historian acquires knowledge of the past. If, in fact, the historian does acquire knowledge of the past, there are people who are skeptical of that, people who think historians really can't acquire knowledge of the past. And what I'll be talking about mainly in this lecture, although I'll say a little bit at the end about philosophy of history in the sense of a general pattern in history, is the second meaning of philosophy of history, namely philosophical problems that are involved in the historian's claims to know knowledge. I should mention, I didn't make a slide of this, but there is an interesting argument that concerns the other kind of philosophy of history, the one that claims there's some kind of general pattern in history, that Karl Popper raised in his book of, came out in 1958 or so, called The Poverty of Historicism. He had an argument that if it's right, would really knock out this notion of a general pattern in history. What he said is, he said we can't have historical laws that about the future, because the future depends on what happens in the future depends on the knowledge people have in the future. And we can't predict future knowledge, because if we could predict future knowledge, then we know it now. It wouldn't be future knowledge. So he said, well, this then we can knock out, if he's right, he's just knocked out philosophy of history altogether. And I see let me put it this way. The argument as he stated it is all right, but it doesn't show anything significant. What's happened here, we can distinguish between two, talking about future knowledge, we could distinguish two senses of that. We could mean knowledge that, on one hand, knowledge that people will have, people that will know certain things in the future, and the second meaning, more restricted one, would be knowledge that people will have in the future, but we don't know now. So presumably people will know in the future that 2 + 2 = 4, but we know that now. But the second kind would be the knowledge that they will have, but we don't have. So of course Popper's completely right that in this second sense, we can't know what people will know in the future, because it's just built into the definition that we don't know it. But that doesn't show there is any such knowledge, or that we couldn't know that people won't acquire such knowledge. Let me give you an example, and maybe make this a bit clearer. Probably some of you took that test they had to get into the oral exam, the written exam. I'm glad I didn't have to take it. I would have failed for sure. But so supposing I said it's impossible for anybody to answer all the questions on this exam because you can't answer the questions you're unable to answer. So therefore no one can answer all the questions on the test. Of course, that would be silly, because you can't answer the ones you're unable to answer, but that doesn't show there are any that you're unable to answer. So you see the same fallacy in Popper's argument. He's saying we can't know the knowledge, we can't know what knowledge we will have, that people will have in future that we don't know now. But of course that's right, but that doesn't show there is any knowledge in the future that we don't know now, or that we couldn't show that people won't acquire such knowledge. So his argument doesn't work. So we can't really get rid of philosophy of history in the sense of a general pattern in that way. Now, if we're now concentrating on this other kind of philosophy of history, the way how the historian acquires knowledge, one point Mises makes is that the historian can use praxeology, a science of human action we've been talking about in the various lectures all week. We can use praxeology to help explain historical events. For example, in Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, which came out in 1963, I just tell you, I remember very well when it came out in 1963. I'm really ancient. So what Rothbard does in there is he uses the Austrian business cycle theory to help explain the onset of the Great Depression in 1929. And how does he do that? Well, the Austrian business cycle theory tells him, or guides him, in which events to stress, say, what is he's trying to explain, how did the Depression come about? So he knows from the Austrian business cycle theory that a business expansion boom is caused by an extending bank credit. So he then looks in the Federal Reserve policy and see is there in fact such an expansion of bank credit? Here you see the Austrian theory of the business cycle is guiding him in trying to figure out which events to emphasize. If the without any theory, the historian wouldn't be able to proceed. The Victorian historian James Anthony Froude once said something like, "History presents an infinity of events. Events which can be arranged in an infinity of patterns." Events can be arranged in infinity of patterns. So you have to know. You have to have some kind of theory to tell you which events you're going to stress. Otherwise, you just have all sorts of jumbled account of things. You'd have what Benedetto Croce called mere chronology, not genuine history, meaning historical explanation. Now, another example of applying praxeology is the very brief account in Human Action that Mises gives of the decline of the Roman Empire. And of course, Human Action is a book mainly on a theory, but praxeology, not on particular historical events. But from time to time in the book, Mises has all sorts of comments on historical events and comments on particular people, and these are extremely interesting to read. So what Mises stresses in accounting for the fall of the Roman Empire is the falling trade between parts of the empire. At one time, commerce was very much flourishing. The trade spanned the whole course of the empire. But toward the end of the Roman Empire, the production was more concentrated on individual estates, the latifundia that people had, and trade very much decreased. And if we say, well, what was responsible for that? Mises emphasizes inflation and price control. There was an expansion of the money supply, and then various emperors, such as Diocletian, tried to prevent prices from rising by imposing very strict price control, and this completely disrupted economic activity and trade. So what Mises is stressing here is trade is falling off in trade and commerce was the main cause in the fall of the Roman Empire. And when he's doing that, he's obviously here using parts of economic theory in his explanation. He's saying, well, look, we know from economic theory the effects of inflation and price control. We know the beneficial results of division of labor and extending the market. So we can see if something, we have inflation and price control, it's going to cause a collapse in trade and division of labor, and we can know that this will have bad consequences. So here you see again what Mises is doing is applying, using economic theory, using praxeology or parts of praxeology to help explain a particular historical process, the fall of the Roman Empire. And he mentions in this connection, he was very influenced by the work of Michael Rostovtsev, who was a great historian of the ancient world, who wrote the Social and Economic History of the Roman Empire. Rostovtsev was a Russian historian, and he'd gone into exile after the Russian Revolution, and he was very influenced in his writing on the fall of the Roman Empire by what he'd experienced under socialism with the Bolshevik regime. And this very much affected what he was saying. And so Mises thought very highly of that book, and it's still considered one of the classic books. Now, what I've said so far, I've tried to show that the historian can use praxeology to help him explain historical events, giving examples of Rothbard using Austrian business cycle theory to explain the 1929 depression, Mises on the fall of the Roman Empire. But it isn't only historians who use or accept praxeology who try to explain historical events. Historians who rely on different theories will very often have different accounts of the same effects, because remember, in the example of Rothbard, well, if you're using Austrian business cycle theory, then you're going to be looking for an expansion of bank credit. If you hold some different theory, then you'll be looking for other things. And we can see an example of this in the famous controversy between Milton Friedman and Rothbard. Was an intellectual controversy, and I'm happy to tell you it was also a personal controversy. They really didn't like each other much. But in Friedman's famous book, Monetary History of the United States, which he wrote with Anna Schwartz, Friedman has a different theory. He has a Chicago school view emphasizing the quantity of money. And what he says is, in the early stages of the Depression, there was a great fall in the quantity of money. He says the Fed was for various reasons, following a policy of contracting the money supply, and he, following his theory, blames the severity of the Depression on that. Now, Rothbard doesn't take that view. He said, well, of course, the money supply was going down, but he said, well, really, that wasn't something the Fed was deliberately trying to bring about. It was just the effects of various things that were happening in the economy elsewhere. And again, what in Rothbard's theory, Rothbard's application of Austrian theory, what's important is the expansion of the money supply in the 20s rather than the contraction once the Depression began. And Friedman's view, does not accept that the Fed pursued an inflationary policy in the 20s, and that led to some of this personal acrimony between Rothbard and Friedman. They didn't agree on this point. They just didn't get on. But I'm not getting into the merits of the position, although, of course, I think the Austrian view is the correct one. But I just want to emphasize that if you have different theories, will affect the explanation the historian is giving. So Rothbard has one account, and he'll be selecting facts that illustrate the account he thinks is correct. And Friedman similarly has a different account, so he has a different view of the matter. Now, I just add one other illustration. I didn't make a slide of this, but to show this point. In the Industrial Revolution, beginning in England in the late 18th century, there's been a big controversy about, did the Industrial Revolution raise or lower the standard of life of the working class people in Britain? Of course, my friend Sadowski would probably answer that question, yes. But the controversy, you can see in this controversy, we can again see how historians' theories will affect their standpoint at this. Supposing, like Mises, and Mises has some very good pages in Human Action on the Industrial Revolution. Supposing, like Mises, you think that the free market is an extension of the market, is the way to increase prosperity, to get people, to get working people and everyone else earning more money, then if, say, faced with facts that you say, well, workers were working in factories under very, what would now seem to us, very bad conditions, then you're going to say, well, how? You're going to say, how can you explain this in a way consistently with the belief that free market helps workers? So what Mises said, looks for evidence that will support that view. He said, look, before the factories, it was just there'd been an expansion in population and people had no, people without the jobs in the factories would have starved. They would have had nowhere to go. They would have nothing to do. So in fact, even if the bad conditions seem to us bad, they weren't so bad considering the alternatives the workers faced. So you see, the theoretical belief is guiding Mises in explaining how the empirical data are to be interpreted. For socialist historians and others, won't have this view of the market, so they'll fail to see the alternatives that were confronting the workers. I'll just say, well, look how bad conditions were in the factories. Of course, the classic source of that is the first volume of Das Kapital, which spends a great deal of time on how terrible conditions were in the British factories. I read the first volume of Das Kapital many years ago. I haven't read the second or third. The reading the first volume is the big disincentive to reading the second and third volumes. But you see how, once more, the historian's theory will help to determine how the historian is interpreting facts and which facts he is selecting. Now, I want to give another case illustrating the same phenomenon how economic theory can influence the interpretation of history. And this one concerns fascism. You know, I'm sure you know fascism. We refer to the system that Mussolini inaugurated in Italy in 1922. And so it was a more broad European phenomenon. Of course, sometimes the Nazis are classified as a form of fascism. Also, Hitler came to power in January 1933. Now, the Marxists, viewed fascism as really a form of capitalism. What they said was, capitalism is breaking down. It's inevitably faced by depressions and it can't continue going. So Marxist view, the ruling class, the capitalist class, wants to preserve the capitalist system. So what does it do? It gets rid of democracy and turns to a dictatorial party to suppress this socialist dissent. The socialists workers in the Marxist view will be turning to the socialists, and the capitalists, to prevent this, get rid of democracy and they establish a system of dictatorship to preserve their power. So in the Marxist interpretation of fascism, fascism is a type of monopoly capitalism. You can find, for example, there's a book that came out around 1934 by the communist leader from India, became a leader of the British Communist Party, R. Palm Dutt, called Fascism and Social Revolution, gives this interpretation. Now, Mises, as comes no surprise, rejected this view. Now, he said, well, look what's happening in fascism and Nazism. You have the forms of private property. You have owners and the factories. You don't have the state owning all the means of production, But in fact, the state is really in control because the state is dictating all the prices and wages, making all the decisions. Say you own a factory, you aren't setting market prices, you just have to follow the orders that you get from the planning authority. So it's really a form of socialism, even though it's ostensibly private. So you see, here again, we have the same pattern I mentioned before, where the theory that the historian has will influence the interpretation. Mises, based on his analysis of socialism, realized that fascism is a type of socialism, and then the Marxist theorists, of course, don't accept that, so they have completely different accounts of fascism, where Mises says it's a form of socialism, and the Marxists say fascism is a type of monopoly capitalism. Now, when I've said this, of course, I don't by any means intend to suggest that one interpretation is good as another. It's just a matter of which theory you happen to accept, because then you want to know which theory is the correct one. And if you're using the correct one, then you will have a very much better chance of coming up with a good explanation of historical event than if you use an incorrect one. Okay, so what I've said so far is illustrations of how the historian can use economic theory, especially praxeology, in explaining historical events. Now, Mises also says that there's another way in which explanation of historical events is influenced by what happens in the sciences, not just praxeology, but some of the other sciences as well. Mises says in Theory and History that a historian's account can't contradict the results of modern science. So if a historian is explaining something, he can't explain it in a way that goes against results of modern science. And he gives, I find at any rate, kind of a funny example, and you'll see why I think it's funny. Maybe it'll show you, which needed no further illustration anyway, that I have an odd sense of humor. But we'll see one example that Mises gives. He says, well, supposing a historian is trying to explain that there were times in European history where there were panics, people had thought there were witchcraft outbreaks, say women were put on trial, in some cases burned, because people thought they were in communion with the devil. It was called, the British historian Hugh Trevor Roper has an essay called The European Witch Craze. So this was more a phenomenon of 17th century, incidentally, than the Middle Ages. So supposing a historian is trying to explain, well, why did people think that there were all these witches around who were in communion with the devil? So one explanation that would come to mind is, there were all these women in communion with the devil, so that's why there were people in reacting to them were just recognizing reality. You know, the devil happened to be more active at that time. But Mises said, well, someone who held that view could come up with a lot of evidence for it. You'd have all sorts of witch trials of witches where women would make confessions that they were in communion with the devil. Of course, these were extracted by torture, but in some cases, at any rate. But it isn't the case that anything you get by torture is false. You might be able to accept some of that. So Mises says, well, you might be able to come up with a case that was what really happened. But for one thing, he says, look, this would go against the results of modern science, kind of a scientific explanation. We don't believe that there are such demonic forces anymore. At least Mises suggests that's inconsistent with modern science. So he says, well, look, the historian couldn't use that. Now, the point that I find funny is, turns out that one of the leading historians of witchcraft in the 20th century was Montague Summers. And the theory that Mises said, well, no modern historian would give, is just the one he gives. So he did believe that. Of course, that wouldn't be a really, really good point against Mises, because Mises could just say, look, he made a mistake. He shouldn't have done that. But in fact, he did do that. Montague Summers was a very interesting character. He claimed to be a priest, to be a Roman Catholic priest, but there's some doubt whether he really was one, but he would just dress in clerical garb. And he wrote all sorts of books on witchcraft and other subjects. One of my teachers, Walter Starkey, knew him or met him. He was one of the rather unusual person, but you still find his books on witchcraft cited, although I don't think very many, if any, people accept his account of the witchcraft panic. Now, okay, so what I've given so far is how the historian can use praxeology and help him give explanations, and also the point Mises makes is the historian has to respect the results of the physical science that can't contradict the physical sciences. Now, there's another very important limit, though. There's a limit to application of praxeology, is that we can't deduce from the laws of praxeology particular events have happened. Say, you couldn't deduce from any law of praxeology that I'm now giving this lecture, or that you couldn't deduce that President Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. Incidentally, do you all know why Lyndon Johnson didn't do any hunting after he became president? It was because Oswald didn't give him back the rifle. Ah, good, I can still get a few laughs, good. Okay, so now, why can't you deduce particular events from praxeology? Well, remember from my first lecture, I was talking about praxeology just gives you the form of any action. It's like, what is true of any action regardless of what it is? Are there general laws that apply to all action? So it doesn't say anything about particular action, the content of particular action. For example, I spoke earlier in the lecture about how Murray Rothbard used Austrian business cycle theory in trying to explain the onset of the Depression, and that he knew, according to the Austrian theory, that an expansion of bank credit will cause a boom. Of course, you have to have a boom without it before you can have a depression. So he was looking for evidence of that the Federal Reserve System was expanding the money supply in the 20s. But he couldn't deduce from Austrian theory that such an expansion took place. Knowing the theory, he could look for it, and in fact, he found evidence that it had taken place, but he couldn't deduce that the expansion did take place from Austrian theory. So here, Mises is in part agreeing with the logical positivists, because they said, well, a priori truths, and remember the praxeology consists of a priori truths, truths that we can know just by thinking about them, because we're thinking about the concept of action, that they don't tell us about anything about contingent events, let's say things that did happen but might not have happened. Say, I might not have given this lecture today, and maybe I just didn't wake up on time. Maybe I didn't wake up on time and just slept through the whole lecture. So then I wouldn't have given the lecture. So that's the fact that I'm giving the lecture is contingent. It's not necessary that it happened. So praxeology can't tell you anything about this. So the basic point that Mises makes is that you can't deduce from praxeological principles that particular events happen, but once you know that they did happen, then you can use praxeology to help you explain them, the events, why they happen. Now, if it's the case, and I think Mises seems clearly right here, that we can't use praxeology to explain particular events, the question comes up, can there be other kinds of law that do help explain particular events? So what I've said so far, well, you can't have a priori laws that explain particular events because a priori laws are saying what has to happen, what can't be false, but historical events aren't necessary in that sense. They might not have taken place. So could you have laws of particular that deal with particular events? Of course, they wouldn't be a priori laws, but maybe you could have inductive generalizations. Say, like I gave you an example. I said, well, I found that the number of people who come to my lectures decreases over the week. So could you have more significant laws like that just based on observations of facts? Mises didn't think you could come up with inductive laws of history in that way. He said that there aren't any constants in human action, so there's nothing really like corresponding to Newton's law of gravity. There's nothing like a historical law of gravitation where the historian could calculate what people will do. Say, if you have in law of gravitation, you're not deducing a priori that particles will attract each other in a certain way, but once you come up with a law, you can come up with, you can see how they're invariably going to act. The law would depend on empirical measurement. But he said you can't do that in history. There are just too many things happening. You can't come up with constants. And we have to accept in history that people's free choice are what he calls an ultimate given, something that you can't explain, go beyond. They just have to be taken as they stand. You can't come up with further laws that explain human choices. So if that's the case, if we can't have general laws of history, does it follow that the historian can't explain individual events at all? I've said that you can't use praxeological laws because they're just a priori truths that apply to all action, don't tell you anything about particular action, then I said that Mises says you can't have inductive generalization. So is there anything left? Does the historian have to say all we have is particular events, we can't really explain them? Mises said, no, there is something a story can do. Okay, you can't use praxeology to explain particular events. There aren't laws that apply to particular events. But you can explain the event in a way that doesn't make any appeal to general laws. You can just grasp the event in its individuality rather than what it has in common with other events. If you have a law, such a law of gravitation, you're saying all bodies will attract each other in a certain way. It will apply to all physical bodies. You're not singling out this piece of matter as opposed to that one. But Mises said, well, in historical event, you can get another type of explanation that does refer just to the individuality of the particular event. This is what he calls this specific understanding, or sometimes he uses the German word Verstehen, sometimes also he uses the word which I think he coined, thymology, from the Greek word thumos, meaning the spirited part of the soul. So he says there's this special way of understanding, specific understanding, where you can understand an event in its individuality without appealing to general laws. Now, how does this work? Well, remember, we're all actors, not meaning we're all in stage actors, but we're all doing things, we're acting every day. So we have, from our own experience, we can make judgments about the goals and beliefs of people just based on our own experience. Say, we want to understand what somebody's doing, so we can say what are their desires, what desires did they probably have, what were their beliefs. If we can come up with some combination of desires and beliefs that will account for their doing that particular action, then we can explain what they're doing. So what we'd be doing is the historian would be trying to say, what are some of the relevant factors that can explain why someone did something? What are the, if say the historical actor had certain desires, certain beliefs about the world, this would account for his doing that, so that's how the explanation would proceed. Now, that's rather general, but maybe we can make it easier to understand by a particular example. Suppose we're historians trying to explain Lincoln's policy in 1861. You know, Lincoln was faced, he said, the southern states had seceded. How is he going to respond? It looked like is he going to reinforce the Fort Sumter? Is he going to let South Carolina take it over? What is he going to do? Incidentally, I'll just mention here, you know what the manager of Ford's Theater said to Mrs. Lincoln the day after the assassination was, I'm sorry, Mrs. Lincoln, no ticket refunds under any circumstances. Okay, so supposing the historian's trying to understand Lincoln's policy in 1861. Well, how can he do that? Well, he could take evidence. What were Lincoln's goals? He was very much against secession. He thought we needed to have a strong national state. The states didn't have a constitutional right to secede. I guess Lincoln hadn't read the books of Tom Woods and Tom DiLorenzo, so he didn't realize his argument weren't very good. So he thought states don't have the right to secede. And he also wanted to stop the spread of slavery. So we say, well, what were his goals? And what sort of belief, what were some of his beliefs? Well, he thought that he had or could get pretty fast enough military power to compel the southern states to return to the Union. So if you have, well, those were his goals and those are the beliefs he had, then you can explain what Lincoln's policy was, that Lincoln decided to reinforce the fort. He didn't withdraw the federal troops that were there. So what is the historian who does this doing? Well, he's not appealing to general laws. He's not saying, whenever someone is facing a revolt and he's opposed to the revolt, then he's going to react in such and such a way. No, he's saying, in this particular situation, Lincoln had various beliefs about the world and various goals, and given those beliefs and goals, then we can understand what he did. Now, when we're talking about specific understanding or verstehen, there's a mistake that sometimes people make is, as I presented, what the historian is doing is trying to reconstruct, explain an event by reconstructing the situation as it appeared to the actor. So we're saying in the example I gave, well, given Lincoln's goals and given his beliefs about the world, what beliefs and goals do we need to attribute to Lincoln so that we can account for what he did? Say if we had other goals, suppose we thought mistakenly that he thought secession was all right, then that wouldn't explain why he decided to reinforce the Fort Sumter. So we have to get the right combination of beliefs and goals in order to explain what he did. So some people say, well, we're trying to reconstruct the person's thought. In effect, we're trying to look at the situation the way the person did. We're kind of looking at things from Lincoln's point of view. So then doesn't this suggest we're kind of sympathizing with him, we're empathizing with him, we're taking things his way? So sometimes people have wrongly compared verstehen kind of to a type of art, a view of art appreciation, where we try to have some philosophers of art thinking, looking at a painting, we kind of have a direct feeling for the painting. So people say, well, here is verstehen, it sounds like it's something that we have to have some kind of sympathetic understanding of what the actor is doing. Now, one of the greatest modern philosophers, Saul Kripke, I don't know if anyone has read him, he's one of the great thinkers. He had a very early paper on Collingwood's philosophy of history. We'll be talking about Collingwood a little later. And what Kripke said is, look, if you apply, Collingwood was one, as we'll see, who had this, followed this method of specific understanding, and he influenced Mises. So Kripke said, well, look, what happens if you apply this to Hitler? You're trying to explain Hitler. So you think, what are the goals that Hitler had and what his beliefs he had that would explain his actions? So then he said, well, what's going to happen? Then you're going to, the historian who does that is going to wind up sympathetic to Hitler. But that, I think Kripke was wrong there, because when you're doing this, you're not adopting the beliefs and goals of the historical actor you're trying to explain. You're just saying, what are the beliefs and goals that the actor has that will, if you attribute them to him, will enable you to explain what's going on? So the point here is to avoid is that, remember, when you're talking about the value judgments of others, say you think Lincoln thought that preserving the Union was a good idea, you say he wanted to preserve the Union, you yourself aren't adopting that value judgment. You're just making the statement, a claim that he had the judgment. You're not having a value judgment yourself. So history, Mises thinks, can be written in a value-neutral way, even though when you're trying to explain actions, you're appealing to the value judgment of others. I go over this point, I think it's fairly straightforward, but it did on one occasion a few years ago get me into a bit of trouble. At one of the Austrian scholars conferences, we've since changed the name of the thing, but that time was Austrian Scholars Conference. My friend, Roberta Modugno, some of you may have met her, she was here earlier this week, was giving a talk, and she asked me to help her in the question and answer period. I don't think she really needed help, but she thought maybe her English wasn't, she might have problems understanding some of the questions. So one person in the question period said, isn't ethical relativism the view that ethical judgments are relative to particular societies or classes or whatever? Isn't that a self-contradictory belief because the ethical relativist doesn't think that his own belief is relative? He thinks that's true, but he's saying all these ethical beliefs are relative. So I said, no, look, it's perfectly consistent for somebody to say ethical relativism is absolutely true, because that isn't an ethical relativism, a statement of ethical relativism isn't itself a value judgment. It's just a statement about value judgment. So when I said this, the whole audience started laughing. I wish I'd gotten as much response for some of my jokes. So even worse than people not laughing, my jokes is people who do laugh and what I intend to be serious statements. So you see, you have to, but the point to remember is, if you have a value, if you make a claim about the value judgment of someone else, you yourself aren't making a value judgment. You're making a claim that the other person held such a value judgment. That's a descriptive statement. Now, another mistake sometimes people make, who attack, who don't like this notion of specific understanding, is they think this requires taking the historical subject's words at face value or not comparing them with hard facts. So say, if you look, say, at Hitler's speeches in September 1939, he said, well, look, all the Poles are all set to attack Germany, so I've got to do something defensive to stop them. Now, a historian who was trying to explain what Hitler was doing could certainly look at what was going on in Poland and see whether Hitler was right or not. You wouldn't have to accept Hitler's views of things just because you were trying to explain what he did. And also, when we talk about specific understanding, it doesn't imply the historian can know the truth just by some kind of non-rational process, some kind of instinct or intuition. And as an example, to illustrate what I have in mind, there's a very good essay by Mises called The Treatment of Irrationality in the Social Sciences. And in this article, Mises criticizes one of the greatest 20th century medievalists, Ernst Kantorowicz, who had a famous biography of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II, was very influential in Germany. Many people read this, including Hitler, was an ardent admirer of this book. But Mises says Kantorowicz has taken the symbolism used in the Holy Roman Empire at face value. He hasn't really looked at who was actually in power. Kantorowicz thought it was overemphasizing Mises' view how much authority the emperor had based on certain kinds of coronation symbolism. So you see, Mises, in using specific understanding, is not at all taking what the historical actors believed at face value. Excuse me. Now, as I mentioned before, Mises was influenced in his treatment of specific understanding by the British philosopher and historian R.G. Collingwood, Robin George Collingwood. One thing Mises liked about Collingwood, he thought Collingwood was one who understood the a priori nature of economics. But Collingwood said, and you'll see the similarity with what Mises was saying, that the historian should recollect the thoughts of the people he studied. So what he went further than Mises. He said, if you've correctly explained what someone has done, you yourself are having the identical thoughts as that person. So supposing a historian succeeded in explaining what Lincoln did in March 1861, then Collingwood's view, that historian would have the exact thought that Lincoln did. It wouldn't be two thoughts, it'd be one thought. Mises didn't go that far. Collingwood here was applying a particular doctrine of British idealism, kind of I won't go into what it is, rather an odd view, but in Collingwood's view, the historian has who's successful has the identical thoughts of the historical actor. And I just mentioned, I won't discuss their views there, other writers that Mises was influenced about this special way of understanding, included Wilhelm Windelbahn, Wilhelm Dilthey, Heinrich Rickert, and Benedetto Croce. So there were a whole series of writers that Mises was influenced by. Now, for those of you who had the misfortune to go to my lecture yesterday, you'll remember that the logical positivists were opposed to Mises, and philosophers sympathetic to positivism, such as Ernest Nagel, not to be confused with Thomas Nagel, who's a contemporary philosopher, were opposed Mises here. What they said was, Verstehen, a specific understanding, might be a useful way to come up with possible explanations, hypotheses, but you can't get knowledge from this. You could just get ideas that would have to be tested out. The problem with specific understanding is, I'm supposing somebody says, here's what Lincoln was doing. The only way you can judge that is by how satisfying you find the explanation. Do you think that's a convincing account of Lincoln and policy? They said, well, that's very unscientific. And what the historian should do is instead appeal to general laws of history. You know, the most important statement of that view, you'll find in an article by Carl Hempel called The Function of General Laws in History that came out in 1942. And following one of Hempel's critics, W.H. Drake, this view is usually called the covering law model. So what the covering law model says is really historical explanation is just like scientific explanation. You explain an event by finding the general law that applies to it. This notion of a kind of a special, specific understanding is wrong. It's unscientific. What you need to do is come up with general laws. Now, the problem with this is that there aren't any such laws. Say, if we're trying to explain why Caesar crossed the Rubicon, there aren't laws that say ambitious generals that are faced with an order that they think detracts from their honor will, under such and such conditions, disobey the honor. We just don't have such laws. So the positivist proposal would really get rid of history altogether. I'll just say also, I should mention, historians use this technique that resembles specific understanding, which is construction of ideal types. And here, Mises' friend Max Weber was the most important supporter of that idea. And here, when we talk about ideal, we don't mean perfect, like someone was an ideal specimen of a certain type. What we mean is not found in the real world. So what you do with an ideal type, you bring together certain characteristics such as personality traits and use them in helping you explain historical events. So I think I'll skip the rest of ideal types. I'm running out of time. And I'll just end up with one brief remark on this other kind of philosophy of history where you're trying to come up with a general pattern of events. Remember, I criticized Popper's attack on general laws of history. But Mises thought that many philosophies of history, such as those of Marx and Spengler, violated a basic principle, methodological individualism, only individuals act. He said, well, they're assuming that there are other things that act. Say, Hegel had a view that there was kind of spirit or geist that was acting, or Spengler thought there were cultures that were acting apart from individuals. Marx thought the what he called this, the forces of production were an independent force. So Mises said these are all wrong because they violate methodological individualism. I'm out of time now. Unfortunately, this is my last lecture for the week. So thanks to everyone for coming.